Hello, I'm Ron Bailey. It's good to be with you tonight, and this is the first of a series that we're calling Broken Bread. I'd like to tell you where that title came from in the first place. It's over 30 years ago now, since the church that I was part of in Reading at that time decided they would create something they called a church life school. They wanted to share their experience of God in the body of God's people, in their life day by day, as they lived in one another's homes, particularly as they met together to worship and to listen to what God was saying. And we wanted to share that experience. We knew we could send lots of teaching, we could send preaching to different parts of the world, but we couldn't send the experience of actually being part, integrated into a church. So we invited just a small group, usually about kind of 10 or something like that, and they would come and spend 6 months with us. They'd spend their time in the homes. They'd have special partners, English tuition partners, pastoral partners, all kinds of things. And they became part of the church for 6 months. And my part of it particularly was that on the mornings, I would sit at a large Victorian table in a large Victorian house, for that matter, and I'd have maybe kind of 10 folks around me from different parts of the world. We had people from over 20 different countries before we actually brought the church life school to an end. And we would just talk. We would open the scriptures and we'd talk together. So it was a sense of fellowship, eye-to-eye contact. Most of the people were very intelligent and they had a good grasp of spoken English, but English wasn't their first language. So I was very conscious that what we were doing really needed to be not dumbing down in any means, but certainly trying to use language which was accessible for people from a wide background. And we would sit there and we'd talk from hour to time with our open Bibles, and I would teach and they would ask questions. And it was a tremendous time. I learned much more than they did, I suspect. It was a great time. So that atmosphere of sitting around that big oak table, with eye contact, friends in the midst of friends, sharing the scriptures, that's the idea I have in my mind. And as much as possible, I'd love, if it were possible, to create that kind of mood, really, even for these broken bread Bible studies. The other reason is for a particular verse, 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, very easy to remember, 2 Timothy 2:2, is this wonderful verse where Paul writes to Timothy and he says to him that he is to commit the things that he has heard amongst many witnesses to others, that they may teach others also. And that word commit, in my mind, I had a picture of almost a military thing, someone commissioning or sending forth a labour, delegating authority, responsibility to his kind of his lieutenant, if you like, and then passing on. But as I dug deeper, I discovered that the word commit that's used there doesn't mean that at all. In fact, it really means to spread a table. And it's used often in the New Testament, and it usually says something like that, that they spread a table and they sat down. It's used of the story of the feeding of the 5,000, where they sat them down and they fed them. So I want to spread a table so that people who come to the table can eat their fill according to their appetites and enjoy what's here. So if you're ready, pull up a chair, grab a plate, and we'll make a start. So this is study one, and I've got my notes that I was working from. The last time I gave these was 25 years ago, I think. So I'm working my way through that nice and gently. Here's study one. I've called it Galatians and Acts, Paul before his conversion. And my first question really is, what does the very first verse mean? If you were to turn from the end of John's Gospel and then turn straight to the letters of Paul, the epistles, and you'd never read the Acts of the Apostles, it really would be impossible for you or me to understand what the letters were about, because the whole timeline, the whole backbone of the chronology would be lost. And the first question you would ask is, well, who is Paul? He wasn't one of the 12. The second question you might well ask is, what is a church? And the third question you might well ask is, what were churches doing in Galatia, a Roman province which is now the modern nation state of Turkey, or part of it anyway. Let me read the first two verses and just listen to these. Paul, an apostle, not from men, nor through men, but through Jesus Christ, and God the Father who raised him from the dead, and all the brethren who are with me, to the churches of Galatia. Now, if some of you are using a modern Bible, you may well see that little phrase, to the churches of Galatia, on a separate line, maybe even as a separate paragraph. And you may think it's one of these intrusive headings that people stick into the text, but it isn't. It's part of the original. This is Paul's epistle to the churches of Galatia. We usually call this letter the letter to the Galatians, the people, but it's actually the letter to the churches. Of course, churches are made up of people, but Paul is writing to situations that he knows well. He's writing to situations that are familiar to him, and he's invested an amazing amount of time and blood into these churches. So how do we start off with this? So how does this verse mean? Can you see now what I mean when I say that if you went straight from John's Gospel into Romans, you'd come into the letters of Paul straight away. You'd go from John's Gospel into Romans, 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, and the letter to Philemon. That's what, that's 13 letters from somebody that you have no hint of in the Gospel. So who is this man? And how has he risen to such prominence to write such things to churches in these different places? So let's begin just thinking about this. This is what some people might call an introduction, but I don't want you to think that that's going to be necessarily boring. Actually, sometimes, this is a joke coming up, so be ready for it. Sometimes you have to do some boring before you strike oil. And it's a little bit like that sometimes with Bible studies. Sometimes you need to do some hard work to bore down, to find out the context before you actually try to begin to understand what that passage is all about. Now, let me say this to begin with. God has the right to use any means he wants to speak to us, and he will. You'll be amazed at the lengths he will go to bring his will to your notice. But when we are studying the scriptures, we're not looking for verses that direct us into the next step necessarily. We're actually trying to understand the truth behind these things. We're actually trying to create a network of truth and understanding so that what we hear from God, we can almost instantly compare it against or set it in the context of the whole of truth. I've used the word context twice. Here's a third time. When we're studying the Bible, almost the key thing is context, context, context. Who wrote it? Who did he write it to? What was the occasion which caused him to write this letter? Most of the letters of the New Testament are what they call occasional letters. That doesn't mean that he just wrote every now and again when he felt like it. Occasional means there was an occasion behind each one. There was a reason that he wrote Romans. There was a reason that he wrote Corinthians. So if we can put those reasons into a timeline by using something like the Acts of the Apostles, lots of things that are said there begin to have a different depth of meaning. You immerse into the culture and the understanding, and you're not just looking for golden verses or something to kind of cheer you through the struggles of the day, but you're beginning to understand the life of these early Christians. And God has recorded the Acts of the Apostles, and he's recorded these letters, the communications between churches, in such an amazing way so that we can actually enter into that culture and begin to feel what it's like to touch the life of heaven on earth. Okay, let's make a start then. Before Paul's conversion, Paul's life up until this time, he was probably born and lived about the same time as Jesus, so he was probably a contemporary of Christ. Galatians chapter 1, as we've just said, well, the Gospels end with Christ ascending and passing beyond human sight, and then we have to ask all these other questions. So what is Galatians? We'll come to that presently. Galatians has been called the seed plot of the Romans. You know how if you're a kind of an agriculturalist or a gardener or something, you may grow some seeds in a greenhouse or a hot house, and then later you'll harden them off a little bit by putting them into a seed plot to give them a chance to get growing, probably a sheltered place where it's not open to winds or something like that. Doesn't this sound as though I'm a gardener? I'm a good gardener. I love reading about it. The Galatians is like a seed plot. This is where some of these emerging ideas are first planted that come into full fruition and fruitfulness in Romans. But there are other aspects of Romans that make it a bit more difficult to study. Galatians has really had a tremendous impact upon the world that we live in today. In many ways, Galatians was behind the Reformation. Martin Luther carried a copy of Galatians with him. He used to refer to it as his Catherine von Bora. That was the name of his wife. He was inseparable from the letter to Galatians. There are other things that need to be said that aren't said in Galatians that he might have spent more time on, I think. But that's a different kind of a truth. So this letter had a tremendous impact upon a man who in turn had a tremendous impact upon our world. So it's been called the seed plot of Romans. It's also been said that Romans could be called the gospel according to Paul. So here you have the seed of Paul's gospel. Not that it was exclusive to him and that nobody else held it, but this was the gospel that had been revealed to him. On this he's based his life and invested his life. So to understand his gospel, we really need to understand the man. We need to understand his experience, and we need to understand the time in which he lived. So who is Paul? Well, Paul, we can find this from the scriptures, was a Roman citizen. If you're taking notes, you might like to note Acts 16, verse 37, chapter 22, 25 to 30, and you'll see where Paul refers to his Roman citizenship. Now, Roman citizenship could be bought. People had different levels of worthwhileness, different levels almost of humanness. The person who had absolute authority was a man called the paterfamilias. He was the head of a family, not unlike the mafia operates, or perhaps did operate. One man at the top of it all, and that was the head of the family. And the head of the family had the power of life and death. But as you worked your way down, you ended up with the slaves, and the slaves had no rights at all. None at all. Slaves could be crucified. People who were citizens of Rome could not be crucified. They could be executed, beheaded, and put to death in other ways, but they couldn't be crucified. Crucifixion was the manner of death reserved for the lowest of the low, the people who had no status, the people who hardly registered on the scale of what it meant to be human, the people who had no rights, no privileges, the people who were regarded as human tools, slaves to be used and when worn out, thrown away. Now, Paul was a Roman citizen. That's possible that his father, he says he was born a Roman citizen, so it's likely that his father was a Roman citizen before him, and he may have done some service to the state, or he may have bought it at great price, or it may have been his grandfather. I don't know how far Roman citizen lasts as it goes backwards. So, at some point, his family, the heads of his families, had become Roman citizens, which meant that Paul was born with rights as a Roman citizen. He couldn't be flogged. He couldn't be bound and flogged without a proper Roman trial, which will give you the pattern to what happens in Paul's life. If you compare the way that Paul was treated with proper Roman trials and the way that Jesus was treated, you'll see that there's an enormous contrast between the two. Paul was treated as a Roman. Okay, we also know that he was a citizen of Tarsus. Tarsus is in the modern country of Turkey, and it's in a part called Cilicia. And if you read again in Acts chapter 9, verse 11, chapter 21, verse 39, and 22, verse 3, you'll find reference to the fact that Paul was from Tarsus. It was an important town with a reputation for scholarship. And some think that Paul was educated here. You occasionally hear preachers say he was educated at the University of Tarsus. That's an interesting bit of speculation. It's possible. All kinds of things are possible. But certainly he was in Tarsus as a child. You'll find that in Acts again. Then his early life. Well, he wasn't only a Roman citizen, he was also a Jew. He was born in Tarsus of Cilicia. And then it says, this is Acts 22 and verse 3, he was brought up in this city. The Greek word brought up really means to nurture, like a parent bringing up a child. So the question is where you put the comma. Some people think that it might mean that Paul was actually brought as a child to Jerusalem and nurtured by his mother there. So you can see how this thing happens. And then if you put a comma at the end of that bit, you then almost start a different sentence, at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the perfect manner of the law. Now, Gamaliel was one of the leading Jewish rabbis of his day. He was a man very, very highly regarded. In fact, he was the grandson of a man named Hillel, who was one of the great, most famous Jewish rabbis. Gamaliel was called Rabban, our teacher, which was a higher title than rabbi, which is my teacher, and he was greatly honoured. He was from the liberal, more gentle wing of the Pharisee sect. And if you look in Acts chapter 5 and verse 34, you'll find an example of his view on life. Paul, when we first meet him, he's a young man. In fact, he's the young man who is holding the clothes of the people who are stoning Stephen to death, the first Christian martyr. So he's called in the Bible a young man, and the word that's used is neanios. That's a Greek word, and it really means someone in between 24 and 25. So he's in that kind of age group. He's somewhere in between his 20s, middle 30s to 40s. But we also know that Paul seems to have been a member of the Sanhedrin. This is a Jewish religious council, and again, very highly regarded. He's very unlikely to have been less than 30 when he was on the Sanhedrin. He may even have been a little bit older. In Philippians chapter 3, and I'm going to read these verses, chapter 3 and verses 4 and 6, he gives us a little glimpse into his life as a Jew. This is Philippians chapter 3, and he says this. I'm reading from verse 4. I'll better read from the beginning, haven't I, really? Finally, my brethren, rejoice in the Lord. For me to write the same things to you is not tedious, but for you it is safe. Beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, beware of the mutilation. He means people who have been circumcised. For we are the circumcision, the true circumcision, who worship God in the Spirit, rejoice in Christ Jesus, and have no confidence in the flesh. There's a definition of spiritual circumcision for you. They worship God, they honour God, they serve God. There it is. We are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit, rejoice, boast literally in Christ Jesus, have no confidence in the flesh. That's a key thing. The true circumcised heart is not self-supporting. It's not independent. It doesn't have the confidence that we can do this. We can, you know, it doesn't have that can-do attitude. It has a can't-do attitude, but an absolute dependence upon Jesus Christ. We are the circumcision who worship God in the Spirit, who boast in Jesus Christ, and have no confidence in the flesh. And then he says this, though I also might have confidence in the flesh. If anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I more so. And then he gives you a list of the reasons why he thinks he is better qualified than anybody else. Circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel. This man was a Jew going right the way back through to Abraham. circumcised the eighth day of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin. Now, Benjamin gave to Israel its first legal king, Saul. So it was an honorable tribe. And then he says, a Hebrew of the Hebrews. Now, this is a key little phrase, because a Hebrew of the Hebrews means that he had been raised with a Hebrew mindset. He hadn't been raised like a Greek, a modern worldly character. He'd been brought up under the strict rule and pattern of people who believed strongly in the Word of God. That's really what he'd lived. So his way of thinking was Hebrew. He spoke Greek without a doubt, probably Latin too. But his way of thinking was Hebraic. That was the pattern of it. There was another group of Jewish people who had been the diaspora or the dispersion people scattered through the Mediterranean, particularly the coastal towns. And they were known as Hellenists. Now, Hellenists were people who genetically may have had the same rights or the same descent as Paul, but they had a completely different mindset. They had a Greek mindset, and there will be a conflict between the people with the Hebrew mindset and the people with the Greek concept, and we'll see how that mindset, and we'll see how that works its way out in a minute. So he says he's of the tribe of Benjamin. He's a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He's stacking up his qualifications to be the most qualified naturally to be chosen of God. A Hebrew of the Hebrews. And then he says this, concerning the law, a Pharisee. Now, the Pharisees were to the letter. They had this notion that because the law of God was so precious, they needed to protect it. So they created lots of other laws, like a fence that they put around it, so that people couldn't even get close enough to the laws of God to break them. The problem, as with all such fences, it obscured the law of God, so they missed the purpose of the law of God. So he was a Pharisee. Concerning the law, a Pharisee. Later on, he says of himself that he was of the strictest member of the sect of the Pharisees. He really was. This man was a straight arrow. He was absolutely the epitome of what the Jews thought a Jew should be. He comes from the right background. He's got the right education. He's trained under Gamaliel. He's probably a member of the Sanhedrin. We know that he endeavoured to keep the law. He said his conscience never convicted him until later on about keeping the law. He says, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, harassing the church, that's the word, chasing them, pursuing them. That's a sign in his favour as a good Jew. He wasn't just a passive Jew who said, yes, I think they're mistaken. He was out to silence the false witnesses that he believed were the followers of the Nazarene. Then it says, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. There you are. When he compared his life to the law, he could tick all the boxes. Yes, I've always had only one God. Yes, I've never had any images. Yes, I've always honored my mother and father, and so on, right the way down the list. We know from Romans that the one that caught him in the end was the 10th one, thou shalt not covet. But at this point he says here, according to the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. And then he says this amazing thing. He says, what things were gained to me, those I have counted loss for Christ. I'll read on. Yea, and yet indeed I also count all things loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things. When Paul wrote the letter to the Ephesians, he wasn't just remembering the past and saying, well, yes, on balance I count all these advantages that I had of negative value in comparison with Christ. He actually says he lost all the status that went with these things. He lost all of it. And he lost it because he converted. That's why he lost it. Okay, let's go on a little bit. So, he was from the straitest sect of the Pharisees, he says in Acts 26, verse 5. It's a an interesting word. It's almost like the strictestest or the straightestest or the extremistestest. It's a kind of almost a double superlative. He was absolutely the top of the pile in his keeping of the law. Already a member of the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 26 and verse 10, he says, "I gave my vote." It's the word really for a stone or a pebble. And that's the way they voted. So if he was on a Sanhedrin, he may well have been one of the people who actually voted in favour of the death of Stephen, something like that. He may even have taken up pebbles at others and thrown proper pebbles. He was a member of the Sanhedrin, which was 71 members with the power of life and death. It's often translated council in the older versions. And here's an interesting thing. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 16, it says, "Though we have known Christ after the flesh, yet henceforth we know him no more." Now, I'm not going to go into what he's referring to in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, but listen to this phrase, "Though we have known Christ in the flesh, yet now henceforth know we him no more." Is that a hint that at some point in Paul's life he had actually had an encounter with Jesus Christ? I've got a theory about that, but I won't bore you with it just now. This does not prove it, but the words, these words might be explained to mean that he had had a meeting with him, and we know that they were about the same age. We also know that he may well have been on the Sanhedrin that condemned Christ. In his later life, this Paul, he was known as Saul in those days, became what I'm calling a passive persecutor. In Acts chapter 5 and verse 34, it says he was consenting to the death. Consenting, that's a kind of a passive idea. It's used of marriage partners consenting to remain together. Perhaps at this time Paul was still under the gentler influence of Gamaliel. But it didn't last. At some point he turned into an active persecutor. And we find that from Acts chapter 8 and verse 3 and onwards. And then we have a whole list of really kind of powerful words. He made havoc, which means ravaged or outraged. He slaughtered. He persecuted, that means harassed or pursued. He wasted, that means to sack or to raise it to the ground. This man was a one-man destruction agent for the early Christians gathered together in the church. He was not just the agent, he was the spearhead of increasing persecution against the churches. He was the one who was going to drag the women and their children, bring them back to Jerusalem, and have them tried, have them flogged, sometimes have them stoned to death. He was a one-man nightmare for the early church. His conversion is almost the equivalent, if you can imagine this, of someone perhaps who was the leader of Chairman Mao's Red Guard. Relentless, fanatical, destructive, who suddenly does a 180-degree turn and heads off in another direction. He was fanatical. He was ruthless. He was relentless. He was utterly convinced that he was right. So that's the man who wrote this letter. Now, how on earth did such a man ever become an apostle to the Gentiles? How did such a man ever come into such a knowledge of Christ and become one of the main channels of God's truth to us in our present age? We'll have to wait for that for just a little while. In the meantime, these notes will be on the BibleBase.com website, and you can follow them through. And if you can, I would advise you to follow them through. And if you can, listen to this message again. And please, before we meet again next week at our table, please read Galatians. Read it from the beginning to its end at one sitting. Find a quiet corner somewhere. Make the time. Maybe the lockdown will serve you a little bit in this. Make the time, read it through from the beginning to its end, gently. Find the rhythms of the book. Don't hurry to get to the end. Just follow it through. And God willing, we'll meet again around this table for some broken bread. God bless you.